Students in Louisiana started this school year almost fully in person. But a week and a half after Hurricane Ida tore through the state, more than 250,000 K-12 students are now waiting for classrooms to reopen. Many are set to return in the coming week, but some students could face a month or more of school closures. Aubrey Juhas of member station WWNO has been following the situation from New Orleans and joins us now. Hey, Aubrey.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey, so do you have a sense of where things stand now? Like, when will all these kids be able to get back into classrooms, you think?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the good news. New Orleans school buildings are mostly okay, and some students could return to classrooms as early as next week. The city's trying to reopen school buildings as quickly as possible, not because they're necessarily worried about students falling behind, but because they know schools might be the safest place for them to be. Some neighborhoods here are still without power, and schools may be the only place that families can access air conditioning, charge their phones, and get food. But even though school buildings are getting ready to reopen, there's still a pretty rough road ahead in New Orleans. In the past, we've seen COVID get worse following a storm because of the increased number of close contacts people have when they evacuate or gather at relief shelters locally. Mm-hmm. So to try to get ahead of this problem, the district is asking families to get their kids tested before sending them back to school. But tests are really hard to come by right now because everything was shut down due to the storm.
Okay, you said you were starting with the good news. What is the bad news here?
Yeah, well, the bad news is that of all the districts that are experiencing longer-term closures right now, New Orleans is actually the only one that's announced a reopening timeline. Mm. Even nearby Jefferson Parish, the state's largest public school district, it's in far worse shape and it has, you know, yet to set a date to reopen. Its superintendent said yesterday that some schools may need to be bulldozed to the ground due to the level of destruction. Wow. Some parishes along the Mississippi River and on the Gulf Coast don't expect to get power back until at least the end of September, and then they'll still have to deal with significant storm damage to buildings. That means more than 45,000 students probably won't get back into classrooms until sometime in October. I spoke with Susan Adams, a high school English teacher in Terrebonne Parish on the Gulf Coast. Her school suffered a lot of damage from the storm.
We all knew that there was definitely going to be water in the school, but the extent of the water in the school is kind of mind-blowing.
She says the walls and floors are slick with mud, the windows are blown out, and pieces of the roof are strewn everywhere. She's taught there for 20 years, and she's completely heartbroken. She's also really worried about her students.
You know what I mean? My students stayed and lived through the storm. Like, they were here. They didn't evacuate. I think quite a few. And I think quite a few lost quite everything that they had. We're going to have to, like, love those kids hard when we go back.
Yeah. I mean, if there's mud in the school building and windows are blown out, I don't get it. How are these students and teachers going to be able to return?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard road ahead, and the big question is there is not a clear timeline. There's no quick fixes. I called up Carl Brookhouse. He's the superintendent of Calcasieu Parish Public Schools, because he was in the exact same situation a year ago after Hurricane Laura hit his part of the state. His district still hasn't been able to fully repair the hurricane damage to school buildings, but he says teachers and students are moving ahead with school as best they can.
They're going to school with concrete floors and no tile on the floor. They going to school with roof leaks when it rains. They're accepting all of that. And frankly, we're having a pretty good instructional year, absent of the COVID issue, of course, which, you know, is a daily debacle.
His message to school leaders who have been hit hard by Ida and to be been hit hard by COVID is, you know, to focus on the students and not let the storm derail their education.
Yeah. That is Aubrey Juhas from WWNO in New Orleans. Thank you, Aubrey.
You're welcome.
The Cows, Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, September 7, 2021. So I have been told. That is amazing. On many accounts, in terms of they're talking nearly 50,000 students in the Louisiana area having their education delayed because of the storm, and then all of this happening within the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the suggestion, don't let the storm disrupt the education. That's all you can do is snicker. Like, what? what? Whew. Wacky times, man. I said a week ago, we talked about Hurricane Ida And we talked about Hurricane Katrina. Talk about tacky. They were saying the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. But we talked about all of this. And I told folks, we, Context of White Supremacy, in my view, some of our signature work is on New Orleans specifically, and Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure. I even emphasized that the hurricane, the major problem in 2005, the levee failure. That is why things are way different this time around. Not that it's great, but not having all those images of flood water, toxic flood water that is 30 feet high, 20 feet high and the like. The levee failure was the major problem in 2005, unless I have been misinformed. But we had Gary Rivlin as a guest on the program. He wrote the book Katrina After the Flood, covered the levee failure and Katrina in 2005 for the New York Times. We had June Cross on the program. She did the documentary film for PBS, The Old Man and the Storm. If you were here early today, you would have heard A.C. Thompson, super important. He did Katrina's Hidden Race War, talking about white people. We were not all in this together, talking about white militias, white vigilantes who didn't even live in Louisiana, who came to New Orleans specifically to hunt, terrorize, kill black people. Super important work. Should not be. That's one of the first things, in my opinion, people should think about when they think about that whole experience, not looters and all the rest of it. Like, wow, white militias were roaming the streets looking to harm, kill black people. Like, wow, that is amazing. List went on. Lots of people who came on during that time period. Kimberly Rivers Roberts, really throughout the time that we've been on the air. We even read Gary Rivlin's book, Katrina After the Flood, which has lots of details about the storm and the recovery effort, racism, white supremacy, chock full of information. I would recommend that you have that in your library. In addition to all of those folks and material, our guest for today's program, she was with us repeatedly. We got lots of great information. The New Orleans Tribune mentioned in Gary Rivlin, Katrina After the Flood, lots of detail from people who were right there, who lived through the experience, are natives of the New Orleans area and can just give a lot of info that is often left out of mainstream outlets, Times-Picayune and other sources. I thought, man, it would be great to reach out to see if we could get her on the program. I'd hear about what the experience has been, what's happening in New Orleans. And even some folks had some serious questions. I know some of our listeners actually reside in the Louisiana area and had to evacuate. So I know folks had questions about things that were happening, including the possibility of a lot of the black residents being pushed out. I know that was a major point of emphasis from Hurricane Katrina, but so thankful we could have her on the program. She was forced to evacuate. Just like our own Irie, forced to evacuate to Texas, I believe. Thankful that she is safe first and foremost. Glad to have her back on the program. Wish it was in better circumstances, but at least someone that I trust to give accurate information about what is happening down in the Crescent City. Joining us live once again, Miss Anitra Brown. Miss Brown, you with us?
I'm here, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for sharing a bit of your time and energy.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear great.
Oh, okay. Awesome. I guess, number one, are you still in Texas or have you made it back home?
I am still in Houston. They're going to have to call and tell me the lights have been on for 24 hours and on my street before I go back. I have been there since, I was there Monday. I went Monday to kind of do some assessment and take care of some things at my home. And as of early today when I checked, I still didn't have power in my neighborhood. That might have changed. I need to check. But when I was there Monday with no power and just the conditions around, you know, with very few stores open, if any were open, you know, they weren't very well stocked. It's just not a place that I could be, that I personally can be, until we get back to something a little bit closer to normal. So I went Monday, checked out my home, and came back to Houston. But been working and busy and connected with things that are happening there since, you know, last week. So hopefully I'll be back home this weekend is what I'm thinking.
Ashe, Ashe, glad you were able to get out safely. And yes, hopefully you will be able to get back soon. She put a point of emphasis, notification that the power has been restored for 24 hours. I thought that is an interesting caveat. Do you have some suspicion that it might be on briefly and then go back off?
Yeah, well, there's definitely, there are still people in the metro area without power. The last I checked, and that was late last night, so again, it may have changed. In New Orleans specifically, there were still about 24,000 people without power, and even more when you get out into the larger metro area. You know, the linemen who are out there, they're working hard, restoring, you know, I guess as fast as they possibly can. But, you know, there's definitely some questions about why the power grid, you know, basically crumbled. Given that people pay hundreds, you know, you have a couple million customers paying hundreds of dollars a month, and you wonder where that money is going, especially when you build a brand new $210 million power plant, and you supposedly upgraded all of your transformers across the region, and it basically crumbled. And so now they're saying, of course, you know, we need to, the infrastructure needs to be better. It's aging. We need to build. And that's going to, you know, it's a burden that's going to fall on the shoulders of poor customers. So who can't get, you know, are having a hard time getting satisfaction for the money they're already paying. So we'll see how that works out. I know you got some questions and everything, but let me just kind of preface everything I'm going to say with this statement. At this point, I am tired of natural disasters or man-made disasters or catastrophes and widespread pandemics mixed up with 400 years of institutional racism, exposing the inequities and disparities that we know already exist. It's time to do something about those things, because we're going to have hurricanes and we're going to have, you know, pandemics are probably here to stay. We're going to have issues and problems and things that happen that we have no control over. The things that we do have control over is this inequity and the disparity and the racism that makes it so that when these things happen, some of us suffer way more than others. And that usually comes down to race and class. So Ida was a different kind of storm. Than Katrina, you know, it wasn't the devastation and destruction, the structural damage, probably on par, but because we did not have that flooding element, it did, you know, it wasn't as, what's the word for it? You know, it didn't seem as extraordinary, but the same thing is happening. You know, it's showing again, exposing the inequities and disparities that make it, that makes something like this a little tougher for some of us than others.
Well said, Ashe. Miss Anitra Brown joining us once again, context of white supremacy. And Gary Rivlin, I think it might be unanimous, all of the programs that we did discussing Hurricane Katrina and now shifting to Ida all came to the same conclusion. Some of them were white guests, some of them were black guests. Yes, the storm did hit New Orleans. Levees burst in some of the wealthy white neighborhoods as well. The recovery was not the same. Black people who had money, that's a big part of Gary right. Rivlin's book, Katrina After the Flood. Even the wealthier black people who were not broke and struggling, even they had a hard time because of the system of white supremacy, racism. Talked about all that in detail. I guess before we...
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, we remember, you know, early on in those weeks and those days and weeks after Katrina. So you have an area of New Orleans called New Orleans East. And there are some very affluent black folks that live out in some really nice neighborhoods in New Orleans East. And, you know, while we were all out of the city, you know, you had the power brokers. They're talking about turning New Orleans East into a green space. So even money you thought about it, they wanted to. They wanted to turn it into green space and parks. And so even then, you know, your money, if you were Black, your money wasn't that much of a protection for you against the supremacy, white supremacy. So
super important context of white supremacy that comes up often. Before I get to the power situation, I did see some reports today that they said by the end of today, about 90% of the, at least New Orleans, the folks in New Orleans should have their power back. Now, as she said, the outlying areas, that is a different story entirely. But at least for the folks that are in New Orleans proper, about 90% of folks should have their power back. Even still, that's still about, as she said, about 25,000 people who would still not have power. And just for context, I'm in Seattle. We don't have all that heat and humidity. I think our temperature today was 75 degrees. So
I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, I didn't quite hear. Let's see. Make sure being heard. Okay.
All right. Let's try that one more time. I said, I'm here in Seattle. 75 degree. That was our high for today. I don't think that's the case down in New Orleans. So not having power there can be absolutely lethal in terms of not having air conditioning, refrigeration, all the rest of it, especially if you have older population or anyone with medical concerns.
Yeah.
Just going Hurricane Katrina. Oh, yes, ma'am.
It not can be is. I mean, today alone, the death toll went up to 26, I believe, today. And nine of those deaths, the coroner has directly attributed to heat exhaustion. So the death toll for the state went up to 26. That was with 11 additional deaths being counted or contributed to Ida, and nine of those 11 directly in New Orleans. So 11 more took the toll up to 26. 11 more in New Orleans took the state's toll to 26, and nine of those 11 directly attributed to heat exhaustion. So it's not a situation of it can be. It is. It has been. And so it's you know, it's very important that people understand that it's not just and that brings me to something I am dying to talk about, but it's not, you know, it's not just the electricity off this, you know, with Southeast Louisiana and no air conditioning, no electricity. That it is a deadly situation with, you know, with heat indexes, you have feel-like temperatures that can go into the three digits. So it's not a place you want to be if you can help it. So, you know, some of the folks who are there, stuck in there, it wasn't a situation they could help, couldn't get out for whatever reason. There's no way you would want to be there if you could get out. We're not talking about flood, but the heat, that heat can and has killed. Period.
Extremely important to emphasize non-fatalities from blowing it. Imagine that, no AC, and you refrigerator, old smoothie to try to cool down or what I mean. And a lot of places didn't even have running water.
Yeah, so water pressure was down in places. I can tell you, I was in my house, and I live in the metro area. I was in my house for maybe 3 hours on Monday with no AC, and, you know, and not exaggerating, it was like, I need to get out of here before I pass out. You know, it's not a situation you can play with.
You do not have convincing with.
I'm sorry, Gus. I don't know if it's my device or yours, but you're breaking up again, and I definitely want to hear your question.
Oh, okay. I'll assume it might be me. I'll try again. Let's see. I wanted to make sure I asked, Hurricane Ida struck land August 29th, and there was widely reported, hey, that's the same date, 2005, August, with Hurricane Katrina. And many, many folks, including Governor Edwards, they use the term anniversary to describe this. And I even heard that term used widely in 2015 when they were saying, like, oh, it's the 10-year anniversary, and, you know, let's see how we built back and all that. I kind of questioned, like, is this an anniversary? What do we mean anniversary? Do you Do you use the term anniversary in referring to Hurricane Katrina?
I'm among those who usually use the term anniversary to simply state that, you know, this is the it's been 15 years, or in this case, 16 years, or, you know, it is the 16th anniversary of when Katrina struck 16 years ago today. Oh, well, you know, on the 28th, 29th, that Katrina struck. So I guess we use it loosely. It's not anniversary in terms of a celebration, but more of anniversary in terms of remembering and honoring those who lost lives in that natural and man-made disaster. We use that term. Definitely not something we celebrate, just more of a remembrance, I guess, is the best way to put it. We're not cutting cake.
There's no reason to cut cake at all, no celebration. Nah. I definitely, remembrance, recognize, like, super important, so many lives lost, and everything that happened during that time period, remembrance, absolutely. I guess with Entergy, this was something that was really important in terms of, you talked about the infrastructure, and this has been a major point of debate nationally, infrastructure and lots of different capacities, but specifically there, talking about the energy system, and you talked about the company is called Entergy, E-N-T-E-R-G-Y, and they have a monopoly in New Orleans. Do you think
they have a monopoly in New Orleans? Yes, they have and it's, you know, it's through a utilities agreement that is basically worked out with the city council, the New Orleans City Council, but they absolutely have a monopoly in New Orleans, and it's something, you know, as we deal with this, you have a lot of residents really putting pressure and being very vocal about the city council having to or needing to, wanting the city council to look at that, to look at, you know, what kind of control and jurisdiction, basically, you know, they give Entergy to basically have New Orleans under its thumb in terms of energy, providing energy, providing power to an entire city. And when we know that, it, you know, it's not like that everywhere. There are places where utility companies, including the one that provides power and lights, have to compete. And when you have to compete, you have to make sure, you know, your service is the very best it can be, because people have choices. Well, in New Orleans, you don't have a choice at all in terms of where you get your lights, where you get your power from. It's Entergy or it's nothing. And you know, I can't blame Entergy. It's a Fortune 500 company. They're going to do what they're going to do, which is make money. You know, we have to look at the people we elect, who then in turn allow some of these things to continue. And they have, under their purview, their jurisdiction, the ability to truly hold utility companies accountable for their actions, for how well they're serving their customers or not. And so we, you know, there are definitely calls and questions about, and then not just now, this is long been happening, but of course a situation like what happened with the failure, the crippling of the power grid in the aftermath of Ida, it brings it kind of to the forefront. People have been asking this question and calling for more scrutiny and calling for the city council to revisit this deal that allows Entergy to have a monopoly in New Orleans. They've been calling for this for a long, long time. So we'll see where it goes. You know, the company Entergy just built a $210 million plant in New Orleans East, and it was supposed to be to make the delivery, I mean, the short version of it, make delivery of services better, and You know, people are wondering why wasn't that more of that facility used to maybe stop some of the failure that we saw. Now, I'm not a energy expert. You know, I just know that to have people in a city for a week and a half, some people it's going to be 2 weeks, some people it's going to be even longer, without any power or light, is it's unacceptable, you know, at the very least. Somebody has to do better.
You mentioned the $210 million facility that Entergy just constructed in New Orleans East very recently. Mm-hmm. TheAdvocate.com, New Orleans paper. They had a report just this week, and they were talking about there was a lot of opposition to this plant being constructed in New Orleans East, and citizens concerned about pollution, what type of footprint this is going to leave. We don't need this facility. There are other ways to invest this money. They also said it was going to drive prices up a little bit to have to pay for this facility. So exactly. They had a report. It's titled, Remember That Agitation Against a New Orleans Power Plant? Glad We Have It Now. I won't read the whole thing, but they just have a portion towards the end, and it's talking about the opposition and how they approved the plant in spite of this opposition. And they said, Hurricane Ida has vindicated that decision. The plant was never designed to power the whole city. Its capacity is less than 10% of the city's typical demand. But in this crisis, every bit helps. Among the beneficiaries who saw their lights go on Wednesday were residents of New Orleans East. A lot of black people live there. The folks' plant opponents claimed they were working to protect. Critics are now saying the plant wasn't fired up quickly enough, and there will be time to sort that out. But overall, New Orleanians saw their lights go on faster than their neighbors in Jefferson Parish. What are your thoughts, Ms. Brown?
Is there some truth to that? Yeah, the New Orleanians, some New Orleanians, not all, some New Orleanians, depending upon where you were, saw their power go on faster than, say, neighboring Jefferson Parish. But the residents of New Orleans are bearing the cost of this power plant. And what is some? Pockets of neighborhoods in New Orleans East? If the plant wasn't built to make sure that in a situation like this, that there could be an even quicker response for $210 million, you know, 4 days and a small portion of the city, I don't know if that's enough for me. So it worked kind of, sort of. Some people came on quicker than others, and that's great. Is that enough? Is that worth $210 million? And the questions about, you know, pollution, which are valid, I believe, is that worth people who would have rather seen that money used on green energy efforts? Is that worth rising bills for people who already are struggling to stay afloat? I don't know.
Context of white supremacy. Ms. Anitra Brown, you mentioned within the context of this, the energy failures and other things where people were kind of stuck in New Orleans, not able to evacuate and are now having to just do the best they can in a sweltering environment, hoping the heat comes back on, hoping the water gets restored, where I guess some people were saying, and there was some of this in 2005, why didn't you leave? They told you in advance, the governor came on and told you, the mayor came on and told you to get out of town. Why didn't you leave? You stayed there. It's your fault. And that type of finger wagging. Have you heard that? And what's your response to that critique?
Yeah. I haven't heard a lot of that. I've heard some, but it hasn't been as widespread as it was in the wake of Katrina, because I think to some degree there's a little bit better understanding, as I said earlier about the inequities and disparities. I mean, you know, there are more people, I think, who understand that it's not a matter of I'm sitting here because I want to. You know, I'm sitting here because I can't. I can't evacuate. I don't have, if I have a car, I don't have enough money for gas to get me from point A to point B or out of harm's way, right? Because you had to go, you know, if you live in New Orleans, you had to go far west. You couldn't have gone to Lake Charles or Lafayette. So you're talking about a 3 or 4 hour drive to get you westwardly out of the way of this storm. Even Baton Rouge and, you know, that area a little bit north of New Orleans, into the river parishes, that wasn't far enough. So do you have enough gas money to get out of the path of this storm? And there are people and were people, you know, on that Friday and Saturday before this storm hit that did not have it. And not because they don't know how to save and not because they waste money on frivolous things. It's because they live in a city where the main industry, you know, is tourism. And it's a wonderful, great industry. And we love the hospitality industry. But many of the jobs don't pay a living wage. I mean, several studies have come out that have repeatedly say that it takes $18 an hour to be able to comfortably afford a two-bedroom apartment in New Orleans, and you have people working in jobs for 8, 9, 10. It didn't happen because people aren't doing right with their money or just didn't want to leave. It happened because we live in a state where the minimum wage is still $7.25, and the state legislature, not only are they essentially refusing to raise the minimum wage, but they are refusing to change a state law that makes it illegal for municipalities to raise minimum wages for residents in their community. We live in a state where, you know, our state legislature and our governor basically sold out tens of thousands of residents who were still depending on unemployment benefits, enhanced unemployment benefits that came from first the CARES Act and then, of course, the American Rescue Plan, the enhanced benefits that put under the latest version of the bill that helped people in the wake of the pandemic, put an extra $300 on top of whatever state benefits you may have qualified for. Well, we live in a state where the governor and the state legislature yielded to pressure from business interests because they would rather say that it's lazy workers instead of low wages that kept people out of the job market as we begin to make a slow rebound from this pandemic. They really, really wanted us to believe people aren't working because of an extra $300. No, people aren't working because why would I go back to $8 an hour or $9 an hour when I could, at least for another month, right, stay home with my kids maybe and get maybe a little bit more than I would get if I was leaving my house every day going to work 40 hours a week. So, again, that inequity, that disparity. So you have people who literally about a month before this storm hit, if they were relying on unemployment benefits, had no income, how were they going to leave? So the short answer, are people still saying that? They do. I've heard some people say it, but it's not as widespread because more and more people are understanding the reality of people aren't staying in New Orleans when there's or any other place where you can have some warning because they want to. You know, they're staying because they don't have any other, in many cases, any other option. You know, now I will say, in the aftermath of the storm, you have a community people who pull together and do what they can, and you have systems that begin to see a need and they come together and do what they can. And so in the aftermath of the storm, there were these efforts to get people out to state shelters and things like that. And that was good. But, you know, that was still three, if my calculation is right, we're still talking about responses that were two, three, four days after the storm had hit. So people, you know, suffering in these conditions for several days before it's like, okay, well, now we're going to have some buses bring people to you know, state-run shelters where they can, you know, have some AC, where they don't have to worry about not being able to talk to or communicate with family because you can't get a cell phone signal out. That still took days to happen. So, you know, it's not a situation where people are staying in harm's way because it's fun. They're staying there because for a lot of people, it's where else am I going to go and how am I going to get there?
Oh, messed up. Context of white supremacy. Got to correct that time. Our guest again, Ms. Anitra Brown. If you have questions, the number to dial, 720-716-7300. Oh, the code 564-943. Pound, press *61 if you would like to participate. I thought that was important as well. You heard Ms. Brown talking about the distance one would have to travel to try to get out of the path of the storm, and this was a pretty large storm, driving 4 hours. This is not, you know, some quick, we're just going to be in the car really quick and we're out of here. And then I have been in Louisiana when it is hurricane time. It's right. Not going to be, oh, we just hop in the car. But, oh, no. It's going to be bumper-to-bumper traffic, and that four-hour drive might balloon into
An 8-hour drive. Yeah, right.
Exactly. So it is just the drive, the evacuation itself can be a real tussle. And, in fact, there were people who ended up being stuck in New Orleans who wanted to evacuate, but I guess there was a witness. I just told 8-12 hours it could be to get to safety. If you wait too long, you could be stuck on the road, which is horrible. So they were saying, hey, if you miss that window, you're stuck now. You can't evacuate. So that happened to some people, too.
I was actually one of those people. Let me be clear. Wow. I did not leave the city until Monday. So the storm passed on through on that Sunday. I didn't leave the city till Monday morning. Now, and it was a situation of not because I could not, because – I mean, by the time, you know, this thing kind of formed pretty quickly and, you know, you were hearing, you know, little talk about it maybe Wednesday evening, Thursday morning, and the next thing you know, it's Friday and everybody's talking about a storm and it's like, okay, well, so by the time you kind of got your, even if you had the ability to get out, and I did, you know, I could gas up my car, it was choosing between being stuck on the road for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 hours or let me hunker down, ride it out here, and then move. And that's what I chose to do. I got a hotel room, what we call vertical evacuation. You know, you want to maybe kind of be up high if you can, or at least be in a place that, you know, might be a little bit, you know, more secure than your home or whatever. So I booked a hotel room for me and my daughter. We rode out the storm that Monday morning, got up again, checked my house, and no AC, no me, got in the car. Thankfully, I gassed up, you know, before the storm, got in the car and hightailed it to Houston. So, yeah, you had a combination of a lot of things, people who couldn't and, you know, people like myself who it didn't make much sense to try to leave before because you would have been stuck in gridlock and you didn't want, you know, chance actually not being able to move very much while this thing was happening. So after a certain point in time, around Saturday afternoon, the recommendation was you needed to be, if you couldn't be out of town by Saturday afternoon, then you basically needed to be wherever you were going to ride out this storm. And so for myself, it was a hotel room in New Orleans. But again, you know, I'm blessed. I was able to, even after the aftermath of the storm, you know, get in my fully gassed car and get all the way to Lake Charles before I even needed to gas up again. You know, not everybody, you know, was able to do that.
Context of white supremacy. Wow. That is so scary. I cannot imagine, like, especially being a parent, like, that's frightening enough if it's just, you know, yourself and, you know, life and limb and all that. But, like, wow. Is school for your child, for your daughter, is that looking like it's going to be starting soon?
This is the daughter who was 5 when Hurricane Katrina hit. So now she's 21. Well, almost 21. And so she's in school. She's in college now, of course. And they were already virtual. So they're supposed to be kind of starting back up in the coming week. So we'll see. But yeah, you know, I didn't write out Katrina. I actually evacuated prior to Katrina 16 years ago with this 5-year-old. And so she's 20, almost 21 now. So it's a little bit different, a little bit different. I tell you what, Katrina and everything, even in the aftermath of Katrina, everything that was happening then was a lot scarier for me because she was so young. So I can't imagine. I absolutely know what maybe parents of younger children are, you know, experiencing and thinking and dealing with right now. You know, when they were talking a little bit earlier in the program before I got on about the schools and the recovery. And, yeah, so those schools in Orleans Parish, that fairly unsupervised system of charter schools that operates at their own will, don't get me started. They're going to be starting up in the coming week. But again, as those people who were talking earlier stated, a lot of the schools around there, they don't even have dates. It might be October sometime. And again, we were talking about, you know, it's not that the hurricane has impacted the school system and, you know, destroyed some buildings. And it's that there are already existing disparities and inequities that simply make this worse. I mean, if you think about what's happened with distance learning in the wake of the response to the pandemic, the tech gap, the lack of live instruction in high poverty schools, all of these things were hurting Black and brown children way more than anybody else. And now you add on top of that, our kids may not be in school for another 6, 7, 8 weeks maybe, depending upon when these schools can come online. We're going to have hurricanes. We got to work on these disparities. We got to work on these inequities. We got to work on the institutional racism that makes them pervasive. We ain't getting rid of hurricanes, so what we going to do?
Good question. Good question. I know we have lots of parents out there listening, even some in the Louisiana area. Just you're there. You said you evacuated with your daughter when she was 5 and then doing it this time around with now her, she's being 21 in college. Just you were fortunate. You had the resources to be able to extricate yourself from all that. You didn't have to, you know, be stuck in the midst of all that before or this time around. How did those evacuations impact your daughter, if at all?
You know, I think when she was younger, there was not quite not a full understanding at the time. I think as she got a little bit older, she began to realize that her, you know, I was in, you know, Southeast Louisiana, right out, you know, in New Orleans one day, and then the next day I'm not. And then the next day, because I actually ended up spending 5.5 years in Houston living and working after Katrina. And so, you know, as that ensued, she realized, okay, wow, my life has changed. I'm in Louisiana one day, and then, you know, we pack a bag, and then the next day I'm enrolled in school in Houston, and I'm not living near my grandparents anymore. You know, I guess there was definitely an adjustment. I think this time around, you know, it's a little bit different because of a few different things. I think, I think there was more of an understanding of, okay, we did it once where we kind of left and everything was up in the air. This time it was very clear, I got my house. I'm coming back to it. We'll be back home. But just definitely the stress of it. You know, she's a full-time student, but she also has a part-time job. And so, you know, when we went we went home this past Monday just to check on the house, and she went to pick up her last check, not her last check, but the check she, you know, that was sitting there. They managed to open up the place that she works part-time, and they're trying to get her to come to work, and she's like, I don't even have electricity at my house, you know. But, you know, they don't care. They want workers, and I'm like, well, you tell them when you get AC, you'll be back on the job. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. So just the little stresses that everybody is feeling, but we're managing. I think the biggest, you know, when we talk about these different industries, we've definitely talked about the utility industry, and it's not just Entergy. You know, you got to think about the cable companies, the phone companies, and how their systems held up. And, of course, let me be clear, Mother Nature is something else, you know. I'm not suggesting that a hurricane comes through and there won't be some aftermath that we all have to deal with. I am saying that when you have these companies that charge their customers hundreds of and hundreds of dollars a month for, you know, their service, we ought to be able to get a you know, better, you know, and that doesn't mean it's not going to fail, but should it be as widespread? Should it take, you know, 2-3, and again, they've done great with getting much of New Orleans back online, but let's not forget there are still customers in New Orleans proper, without without lights, without power, and a lot more customers in the metro region, in places like Jefferson Parish, in places like Lafourche and Terrebonne, that were hit harder, but still without power, and are expected to be without power well through this month. And Entergy not only has a lock in New Orleans, but, you know, that's Entergy New Orleans. There's Entergy Louisiana, and they are also operating in some of these outlying areas. And so, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with the people who pay, you know, paying customers expecting better. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And then, you know, you have the internet services, the phone services. I don't think there's anything wrong with customers expecting better, expecting more, expecting, you know, for you to have equipment and an infrastructure that that withstands. You know where you built these towers? You built them in Southeast Louisiana. Build one that would actually, don't tell us it withstands 175 mile per hour winds. Actually build one that does withstand 175 mile per hour winds. I don't know, that I don't think that's too much to ask. But on top of the insurance, I mean, on top of the utility industries, I right now, I'm headed about up the hill with the insurance industry. And once again, I don't even put, you know, the big part of the blame on the industry itself, because it is just that, an industry. They are designed to make money, but it's an industry with lobbyists. And lobbyists who, you know, do their best to make inroads with the people we elect. And it's an industry that, you know, funnels a lot of campaign dollars to the people we elect. And they're not doing enough to put checks and balances on this industry that we have to have, right? Because you can't have a home or a car without insurance. And when we need them, it's a struggle. It's a fight. And again, who gets hurt the most, who gets, you know, the shortest end of the stick? People who are already dealing with the disparities and inequities and the institutional racism in our society, that makes it more and more difficult for them to swim upstream. I mean, I can tell you personally for myself, I am just at my wit's end trying to understand this, what they call additional living expenses or loss of use policy portion of your insurance coverage. You know, I called, I made my claim, and then the first thing they asked me is, my house livable? Ma'am, I don't know how you live, but I don't live without air conditioning. I don't live without lights. I don't live without hot water and proper water pressure. But that's not, you know, for them, that has nothing to do with livable. So, you know, I'm thankful, absolutely thankful that I didn't have to rely on FEMA to be able to have money to put myself up in a hotel room right away, or have money to make sure we got hot meals as we got out of the city. Because if I did, I'd be, you know, absolutely out of luck. Because of course, the way FEMA works, it's like it's almost as if you have two systems that work against each other. The way FEMA works is if you have homeowners insurance, you're pretty much knocked out of any program they have from that provides immediate assistance. You're knocked out of any program they have from the jump that provides immediate assistance because your homeowner's insurance policy is expected to pay for it and there's not going to be a duplication of benefits. Fine. But then when you go to your homeowner's insurance, oh, well, no, we're not going to pay for loss of use expenses because we can't pay for it because it was a widespread power outage. Okay. And then FEMA says, well, give us a letter that says that. And literally, you know, the homeowner's policy insurance people, they're like, well, we can't really write you a letter that says that because it's, how can we deny something that we clearly say we don't cover? Gus, if I could keep it 100, I done cussed a few people out this week because it is infuriating. You and I am by no stretch of the imagination a rich woman, you know, just thankful and blessed that I had the ability to make sure that we could get out of town, that we could, you know, eat, sleep. I had money that I could use for that. It was for other things, but I could use for to make sure that I was out of harm's way, to make sure that my child was out of harm's way. Blessed that I'm able to pay my homeowner's insurance every year, you know, between the homeowner's policy, the wind policy, the flood policy, we're talking about, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 a year in homeowner, somewhere between that, I haven't added it up, but, you know, somewhere around the $4,500 mark in insurance just for the home every year, and then I got to fight with you when I need you. And again, I don't blame the insurance companies. I blame the people that we elect who, when they should be putting checks and balances and requiring better performance from these companies before they allow them to operate in our state, they are instead glad-handing and taking campaign contributions and leaving the people who trusted them enough to elect them out to dry. I don't know. We got any questions?
Yes, ma'am. And just to underscore her very important point about how infuriating all of this has been, and some of this is painfully familiar in terms of the insurance companies not paying black people. I heard William Pierce, one of New Orleans natives, he was talking about his father and evacuating his World War II veteran 96-year-old father to Texas and the racism that they experienced. But I remembered when his father was 80, he lost his house, Hurricane Katrina, went to the insurers, hey, just, you know, look out for me. I paid my policy all these years. I'm a World War II veteran. You all say you care about the veterans. Oh, no, we can't cover that. That's flood damage, not hurricane damage. And, that's not our problem. We clearly say we don't, not covering any of that. That's all on you. Sorry.
Right.
And to have that sort of thing happen regularly, and then more current right now. Now, this was in the Times-Picayune today. Neighbors of New Orleans photographer Laura Bergerall suspect her death is an Ida casualty. Talking about the heat exposure, seems like she was in her residence. She wrote it out. They said the heat index got up to about 100 degrees or so.
Right. Triple digits with the heat index. And see, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. When then you have an insurance company, you know, when you're making a claim and they ask you some ridiculous blank stuff like, is your house livable? No, it is not. 100 degree temperature, 104, 105. I don't know what you call livable, but I'm not putting myself through that. And one of y'all going to give me my money back. I'm not playing. Between FEMA and my insurance company, somebody going to make me whole. It's ridiculous. Because I'm a taxpayer and I'm a customer. What are y'all going to give me my money? Y'all figure it out, works it out amongst y'all, but what are y'all going to give me my money? It is infuriating.
Mm.
And then on top of that, of course, because here's the thing, right? I have insurance that cover. I have flood. I have wind and hail. I'm covered all over the place. But because 16 years ago Katrina happened, I tell you what, these deductibles ain't no joke. I have a low one at $5,000. I've talked to friends that are up to $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 deductible, right? So if I've socked away, and let's be real with it, I've socked away a few dollars enough to say, because I know where I live. So if a storm comes through here, takes my whole house away, I got to at least have $5,000 so that I can meet the deductible. Well, because FEMA doesn't want to give me any assistance because I have homeowner's insurance, and the homeowner's policy doesn't want to call it loss of use because the transformer didn't fall on my roof. Now I have to dig into, this little pot of money I've stocked away to make sure I can meet the deductible so that I can eat and get out of town. One of y'all going to somebody going to get right. Somebody is going to get right. And it's not easy. Like I said, I think I'm, like so many other people who you work hard, you try to do what's right. You're not rich, but you pay your bills. You try to act responsibly. And then the companies, the corporations, the government that you trust, that you fund, makes you jump through hoops to get, what's yours, what's rightfully yours. I pay for this coverage. I pay my taxes. Okay, I see how we're going to do this. Now y'all want me. Oh, I could do it, though. I can. I was nice. Now y'all want me to act another kind of way. And I could do that, too. Let's go.
And I mean, that is stress. People died, Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure, all that stress and having to do all that arguing on the phone and paperwork and all the rest of it to get this filled out and, oh, we're not going to do it, and you didn't fill this form out correctly and all that. I mean, and then you put that in context of everything else.
I'm a black woman in America, stressed enough. Now y'all want me to, okay, we could do that too. Right.
Black mother, no less. The times, they talked about this Miss Burgo who passed away. They think it was from the heat. Now, they talked about, they said that she expressed concern about the heat and lack of power on her Twitter feed, and she mentioned wanting to rent a hotel room on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Reasonable. But when she called her rental insurance agency, the company told her it wouldn't pay for the room because the evacuation wasn't mandated by the city. She wrote on her Twitter feed, so angry, tagging USAA. The company's verified Twitter account wrote back that it understood her disappointment and asked whether she had filed a claim. More paperwork. She's passed away now, so we don't know if she got to finish her paperwork or whatnot. But, I mean, that's, people die around this sort of stress and the heat, everything else around this. Oh, yeah. Everybody does not survive. We are not New Orleans tough or whatever other tacky phrases they come up with. This type of thing causes a lot of folks.
Yeah. A lot of stress. The phrase that we, especially post-Katrina, resilient. We're so resilient. I don't want to be resilient. That means you keep knocking me down and I keep getting up. How about you stop knocking me down? How about you stop pushing and pulling? Leave me alone. I don't want to be resilient. I want you to leave me be. But yeah, that is the classic example of what's been happening. And again, not everybody has you start off with a few hundred, but here we are, myself and many other people. The numbers have dwindled because power has been restored to a good portion of places, but many, tens of thousands of people are still without power. Let's not get this twisted. And so you're going into week one. I mean, you're past week one. You're going into week two. For some people, it will be week three and four. and you got to fuss with the insurance company because they're not considering it a loss of use event because either there wasn't a mandatory evacuation for your area, or as I'm struggling with my company, my personal insurance company, they're saying because there was not, you know, they simply cannot call a power outage, a widespread power outage, a loss of use event. Cool, fine. I'm not going to argue with y'all. Thankfully, I've been able to, you know, I was able to take care of my own accommodation for as long as I could. And then it was late last week, Friday, I believe, that if you were able to get through, file a FEMA claim, that they did begin to provide that assistance, the transitional sheltering assistance, where you use your FEMA number and they directly pay the hotel. But, you know, for a lot of people, again, you're being told so many conflicting things. You're being told FEMA's not going to pay for anything if you have homeowner's insurance. You know, you're being told you got to go through your homeowner's insurance first. So maybe some people aren't filing those claims. I don't know. But what I do know is it shouldn't be that hard, and people shouldn't have to go through all of these hoops. And if there's not going to be power in your neighborhood, in your community, in your city, in an entire region of a state for days on end, if that doesn't trigger, you know, loss of use, I don't know what. I don't know what does. So we really have to be, you know, watching and looking at these pieces and parts. I mean, if the insurance industry does not get called to task for the way they've treated customers again, then we really need to then call our elected leaders, our elected officials to task. If they don't, it's a shame. And this is what had to happen even with, because there are some insurance companies that did. State Farm, I believe, was one. Allstate was another that said, you know what? We don't care. We're going to cover, it's called ALE, additional living expenses. We're going to cover ALE for all of our customers. You know why they did that? The president shamed them. The president got on national TV and made a public address that basically said this is not the time to be mincing words in your policies about what is or isn't covered. Why you have to be shamed? Why you can't do what's right? Because it's right by the people that pay you and trust you. So if the insurance industry doesn't get called to task and is not forced to change as a result of what has happened and is happening, then there just needs to be a reckoning. Because poor people, like myself, I consider myself one of the poor people, you know, not as poor as others, definitely not as rich as many, you know. If poor people struggle and pay these premiums year after year after year, and then I got to fight with you to make sure I can live through 100-degree heat, that I don't have to suffer through that, then what am I paying you for? I don't know, Gus.
Excellent question. Let's see if we can nab a few of the folks who dialed in who have questions for the New Orleans Tribune, Miss Anitra Brown. The number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see, Z's mom out in California. If you have a question for Ms. Brown, you should be with us.
Hi, greetings, Ms. Brown. Greetings, Gus. I had a question about just the housing in general, because even if someone is able to leave, how did, Louisiana coordinate efforts with other states or other areas to make sure that all of those people would be able to find housing without having to pay? Was there any sort of work to do that?
No, the way it pretty much works is you're, you know, with any evacuation effort, of course there is, and these particular services are often offered first to people with disabilities and other issues that might make travel or getting around a little more difficult. So there are opportunities sometimes for people to be bused to some state-run shelters across an area of the state where that's not expected to be impacted by the storm. But by and large, I mean, if you're pretty much able-bodied, you get it how you live. So if you don't have friends or relatives in some place where you can go and get out of harm's way and stay with them for a couple of days, you're booking your own hotel. There's no coordination of any efforts in a grand way that impacts everyone. There may be some smaller pockets of populations that government programs and officials have targeted to ensure, the elderly or people with disabilities, basically those two groups, and of course any caregivers that those people might have. They are often targeted, and it's important. It's a good service. They're often targeted to have an opportunity to do a mass evacuation to a state-run facility, a shelter, basically. But other than that, yeah, if you're able-bodied, then you get it how you live. So you better have money for a hotel, or you better have a good cousin that you can call up and say, hey, I'm headed your way, because that's it.
Wow, thank you for that. That was really helpful. I think my care mate had one question. Oh, no, he didn't. Sorry about that. That'll be all for now. Thank you.
Much obliged, Z's mom, Z, entire attempted family unit. Let's see. One of your, Hurricane Alley brethren, retired firefighter in Florida, I think he might know a little something about having to board up and make sure you have things taken care of, maybe a generator and some water stockpiled. Retired firefighter, mm-hmm. Should be with us also.
Greetings to the guests. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I was just thinking about two questions. As the guest knows, that hours, maybe a day or so before the hurricane hits New Orleans, is already have passed through South Florida. And once it gets in the Gulf of Mexico, it normally heads towards somewhere around New Orleans or somewhere close. It's essential that there is a method of transportation for especially the elderly or people who have physical handicap. Is there something like that that's going to ever be planned or for New Orleans to be able to provide public transportation for such groups?
Yeah, actually, in cases where there is a mandatory, and it's typically a mandatory evacuation, the city of New Orleans and other municipalities and areas in the metro area, they typically have a system in place to move, definitely targeted to the elderly and people with disabilities, to move them to safer places. What happened in the case of Ida, of course, is that if you were inside the levee protection system, there wasn't even a mandatory evacuation. If you were outside the levee protection system, there was a mandatory evacuation. And so shelters, and by shelters, simply safer places in these communities were staged for people who wanted to ride out the storm someplace other than their home. Because there was not a mandatory evacuation inside the levee protection system, this wasn't really stood up as much in New Orleans. I'll give officials the do what do is do. They have done in these ensuing days. They've done a lot of work getting people they've made some effort in providing opportunities. I'll put it like that, in providing opportunities. There's been free bus transportation out of the city to state-run shelters where people can, you know, wait out this time without electricity and air conditioning in more pleasant facilities. So they started providing that transportation for people who otherwise would not be able to do it. And again, of course, in situations where there is a mandatory evacuation, they do stand those kinds of programs up. But again, like you say, definitely targeting more or less the elderly and people with disabilities, important groups, of course. It just, you know, because there was no mandatory evacuation inside the levee protection system for this storm, there wasn't a lot of that in the first, you know, the beginning. But, of course, as things in the aftermath, shelters opened across the state and transportation was provided for people who needed it to get to those places.
Okay. My last question is, and it has something to do with the first question, thoroughfares that would render a expedient means to get out of harm's way.
Right.
Thoroughfares, and these thoroughfares are normally, unfortunately, are made right through areas where non-white people stay at. Is that the situation in New Orleans? If they are to build more thoroughfares so travel outside of the city would be more efficient, who would it harm the most?
You know, some of the, as I'm sitting here thinking about some of the alternative routes we tend to use when, because like the main thoroughfare in and out east to west is I-10, north to south is I-55. But then, of course, you have Highway 90 that I swear for 20 years they've been trying to, you know, there's been this plan to turn it into an interstate, but right now to turn it into I-49. And there'll be parts of Highway 90, which runs east-west, parts of Highway 90 where you will see I-49. It hasn't come to fruition yet, though, in a real way. But, you know, yeah, that's definitely a good alternative route out of the city. And for the most part, it's running through, you know, communities of color, a lot of that, a lot of those places. You're right. One of the things that happened in this particular instance, too, in terms of, you know, since we're talking about the thoroughfares and the transportation and getting out, you know, this kind of happened so fast that there wasn't even an opportunity. I'll put it like this. Officials felt like it was too late to order contraflow, which is something that is often done in cases of mandatory evacuations. Basically, for anybody who doesn't understand what contraflow is, all roads head out. So even, you know, the roads that's the eastbound lanes that are heading into the city at a certain time, if we have a mandatory evacuation or even, you know, a voluntary evacuation, we are going to then take I-10 east and turn it into I-10 west, basically. Every road is heading out of the city until everyone who wants to get out gets out. Well, that didn't happen. So you have people like me, even in the aftermath of the storm, I-10 was flooded, couldn't get out that way. I took Highway 90 out. And again, you're right. It is a section of, you know, it's an alternative route, especially when you can't get across the interstate, and it's running through a lot of our communities. But I had to get out, so I got out. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
You. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired in Florida, hurricane expert veteran himself. Number again, 720-300-6443.
You were breaking up a little bit, Gus.
Brown, they've been thought I figured things out. I had not. Thank you kindly for the update, sir.
Try that again. For Ms. Brown, you and an even retired firefighter in Florida, you all are in areas where they've had so much talk about what they're calling climate change. I know some folks, the language will change. They'll use, you know, other terminology to refer to this. I know this is one that's kind of contested. Some people don't think that such a phenomenon exists. You've been in the Louisiana area and had to evacuate for a few storms. Do you invest in the notion of so-called climate change? And do you think that's impacting what's happening in your area?
Absolutely. You know, we talk about climate change is important. It's unfortunately an issue. Sometimes when we talk about it in the Black community, our, you know, ears aren't turned on as much. I wish we would stop using phrases like climate change and start using phrases like environmental racism. You know, when we begin to understand that where chemical plants are built in our communities, and how much all of this not only is affecting, you know, our personal health, but if, when you have these emissions going into the air, affecting the quality of the air around us, affecting the weather, and then when the storm comes, you know, it runs right through our communities. We don't have the mansions, you know, so it's knocking our roofs off. It's such a full circle thing. And so climate change is definitely an issue. It falls right in line with this. And like I say, our ears don't perk up as much when we talk about it. I like to talk about environmental racism. You know, I like to talk about how all of this stuff is connected to the inequities and the disparities that we've been dealing with in this nation as a people for 400 years. So, you know, the fact that, you know, and you go into any, just about any community, I don't know what it's like in Florida, but I know in Louisiana, any community, and if you show me the power plant, if you show me the chemical plant, I'll show you the Black neighborhood right next to it. That, you know, so Israel.
Cancer Alley, I think we've talked about Harry A. Washington's book, A Terrible Thing to Waste. And in fact, that was just today on Democracy Now! My BFF, Amy Goodman, they were talking about the chemicals that have been dumped, released either into the air or in the water over the past, whatever, week, 10 days or so since Hurricane Ida, and the damage that was doing. These were Black people on that were talking. They had their video cameras out, and they were going out. They were looking. They were like, look at that oil spilling right there, where they have been really reckless in treating all of this. And then right where Cancer Alley, we bring that up all the time. That's right in Louisiana. With this being a reality, we call it environmental racism or climate change, but all of these disastrous effects of white people being reckless and harming the planet is there any thought to, man, I don't know, is New Orleans, is this going to be habitable? If there are going to be these type of storms on a more regular basis, is this sustainable long term?
I guess conventional wisdom would say at some point, because where New Orleans is, there's the river, there's New Orleans. It might seem plausible to say that it isn't sustainable, but it could be if we changed, you know, if we did something different. The problem is, I don't know if we're ready. And when I say we, I mean society at large, if we're ready to do something different. We had a state legislature, about three sessions ago, that refused to pass a bill to prohibit building a public school on a former toxic waste dump. So, if we keep going like that 100 years from now, there probably won't be a New Orleans. You know, if that's our mindset, if we don't want to protect the environment, if we don't want to protect our health, if we don't want to protect communities, and when I say a public high school, I'm specifically talking about one that is in a Black neighborhood that Black children would have gone to. Something that simple, that basic. Hey, let's not build high schools. Let's not build schools on farmer toxic waste sites. We won't even do that. So, yeah, 100 years from now, New Orleans might literally be a place that used to be on the map, and I don't know. I don't know, Gus. Gotta do better.
Context of white supremacy, environmental racism, very important. Cancer Alley talked about that for years. In fact, even I was checking, just as you were telling us about the school on the toxic waste dump, and we don't want to move it. Let them, even once we get school back in session after all this, whenever that's going to be, toxic waste, whatever it is. They had a report. Now, this is from, make sure I get the date correct, March of this year. Excuse me, April 7, 2021. Their houses were built on a landfill. Finally, New Orleans asks their interest in buyouts.
Mm-hmm.
Just a tip a little bit. It says Jesse Perkins fears for his granddaughter each time she plays in the backyard. Patches barren of grass be more than just dusty clothes. She could ingest some of the toxic soil on which Perkins' house was built. When we see bare spots in the yard, we cover it, Perkins said, explaining how he lays boards to limit contact with the arsenic and lead-tainted dirt. Why
right.
Can't
see, this
my
is about
grandbaby...
Garden Plaza, right? That's about Garden Plaza in New Orleans?
Yeah.
And that's it, yes. Their houses were built on toxic... I guess it was in the 70s that neighborhood came up... And an entire community, a neighborhood built on a toxic landfill, and of definitely high rates of cancer and other illnesses that people certainly have every right to believe can be attributed to the fact that it was built on a toxic landfill. And if I'm not mistaken, this was, you know, a City of New Orleans HUD kind of project some, you know, those many years ago to provide affordable housing opportunity, home ownership opportunities to low and middle income African Americans. Oh, but, you know, never mind, it's on top of a toxic dump site. And so all the residents of Garden Plaza really want is enough money to buy a home somewhere else. And that has been an uphill struggle for, since I've been around, you know, I don't know. And again, that's the mentality, you know. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the next few decades and you know, scores of years, because right now the mentality, and this is from, you know, people who should be doing something about it, is kind of like to just wait and see or act like it's not a big thing when it absolutely is. It absolutely is, you know. So if you think it's okay to live on top of toxic and you know, they'll talk about mitigation all day long. If the site was mitigated, da 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 da. I'm not trying to hear nothing about mitigation. That just not enough for me. How about we just don't build on top of what used to be toxic dump sites? How about we just don't build schools on what used to be landfills? Let's try that instead of talking about, well, these mitigation efforts were taken and, you know, so much of whatever was toxic is no longer there or taken out of the land or not enough. Let's not do it. But that's historically and, you know, recent history, not long history, Garden Plaza is ongoing. The high school I was referring to, Booker T. Washington, got built a year, you know, was finished maybe a year ago. We're not talking like ancient history. This is a recent history. We keep going and allowing to happen and watching the powers that be work in a system that makes it impossible for anything better to happen. Nothing's changing. So I don't know. It's frustrating. You know, but Marvin said it makes you want to holler. I don't know.
50-year anniversary, Marvin Gaye, absolutely. Standing in the rain. Oh, and he talked about environment. He was talking about environmental racism on that album, too. He talked about that. Ecology. Anywho, I totally forgot. This is so important. Should have been first, baby. And it's been right there, the little thread in the midst of all of this. All of this is happening within the context of COVID-19 and the pandemic. They've been saying that the numbers in the state of Louisiana in terms of cases have been pretty bad. That's one of the spots that consistently has gotten attention as, oh, man, it's not too good down in this part. And they've reported that the vaccine rates are not very high either in that part of the world, which may be contributing to the problem, they say. How, I guess, even before all of this, what was your assessment of what was happening with COVID-19 and the vaccine effort or taking it serious in the state of Louisiana, New Orleans specifically?
Yeah. So at this point, you know, and this is just from what I, because definitely, yes, those rates of cases were rising. It was primarily, we're talking shifting anywhere between 85 and 90%, those 91%. Those cases were rising among the unvaccinated. Early on, there was definitely this narrative about vaccine hesitancy in the Black community, but I don't think the numbers are bearing that out, right? I think the hesitancy, the lack of people getting it, I don't think that's Black people. Not to this great degree to where we are primarily contributing to this lack of vaccinations. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't Black people who haven't gotten vaccinated. Of course they are. But I think it's more, you know, it's definitely just as many, if not more, other people who are refusing to get this vaccination for whatever reason. So we've seen these rates rise. We've seen the cases rise among young people. And then when you add to that what has happened now, this natural disaster, well, let's just say you have people who are, you know, having to evacuate and have nowhere else to go but a shelter. You know, how do you get a couple of hundred people in a shelter and socially distance? So it's only getting, you know, it's only being exacerbated. You're getting people who are now fanning out, right? Because if I'm in New Orleans or the surrounding metro area or anywhere impacted, anywhere that was impacted by Ida, and if I can, I've gotten the heck out of there. And if I have COVID and got the heck out of there, I just brought it somewhere else, you know. So you definitely are going to see these cases rise. You're going to see COVID-19 and the pandemic being exacerbated by the impact of Hurricane Ida. And again, I don't think, you know, a lot of talk and a lot of targeting of Black communities when it came to encouraging people to get the vaccine. I don't think that necessarily needed to be the only space or place. I think that, you know, we have a large, put it like this, Louisiana is roughly 32% Black, and I would say, you know, in the 60-something percent white. If you have hundreds of thousands of residents who are not vaccinated, when you look at the demographics, when you look at the racial makeup of the state, you cannot attribute the unvaccinated to hesitancy in the Black community alone. Impossible. So we have an issue. We definitely have an issue that, of course, is not only being exacerbated, only being made worse by the fallout of Hurricane Ida. And I don't know what we do. You know, I think you have so many different, you know, so many different things at play. You know, people don't want to wear a mask. They're mad because you tell them they have to wear a mask. They, you know, they don't want to socially distance. They want everything in the world open. They want to go wherever they want to go and do whatever they want to do. And then they don't understand why these cases keep rising, you know. So now you can't have Jazz Fest. Well, probably wasn't going to have it anyway now, because of the aftermath of Ida, but, you know, they had planned to have Jazz Fest in October, I think, yeah. And it was canceled because of the rising cases of COVID-19. several other festivals that were set for the fall got canceled because of the rising cases of COVID-19. And so maybe that's it. Maybe if it keeps hitting them in the pocket, which is probably the only thing they really understand, they'll wake up and do what needs to be done to get back to something that almost looks like it used to look, because I don't think we'll ever be normal again. You know, I think it's here. And so it's how we mitigate. It's how we, you know, how we protect ourselves against it. But if you want to keep just kind of doing what you've been doing, then you're going to keep having the same results. And I think at this point, anybody who wants to get the vaccine has gotten the vaccine. And so I don't know what we do next. Like, I don't know what we do. I don't know what we do next. The vaccine has been available since what? Late last year, if I'm not mistaken. Anybody who wanted to get it has gotten it. Y'all have offered people money. Y'all have offered people a chance to win $1 million. Anybody who wanted it has gotten it. What's next? Do we force it? And that's happening. You have college campuses. You have places of work that are saying you get the vaccine or you're fired. You get the vaccine or you can't come to school. So, I don't know. We're used to sometimes being told either you do this or you know, it's hitting us a little different. It's like, oh, okay. But some other folks, they ain't used to that. They want to file lawsuits. Then they forgot they live in a right to work state, you know, which they love until it affects them. And now they realize, oh, yeah, that means I don't have a right to this job. If I want to work, I got to do what the boss says. Oh, that's what that means. You ain't know what it meant till now. So we'll see.
We will see. I know I have already seen in terms of, you're not the boss of me, and I'm going to do what I want, and I'm not gonna wear a mask at school, and I'm gonna, we wanna go out to the stadium, and I don't wanna wear a mask. Let's go see the Saints. I don't wanna wear a mask there either. I have not seen black people out being defiant, obstinate about any of this. I have only seen droves, and I mean sometimes it's been like thousands of white people collectively. They're not out protesting about your school.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Out protesting. Acting a
you
fool.
You don't got to be doing nothing and get shot. So you think we about to go? You think we about to go out here and make a scene over a man, or showing you my vaccination record on my phone? Yeah, I could be sitting in my car with my hands on the wheel and got to watch you. Make sure you're not pulling out your. So no, we're not the ones making the stink about it. And I think but like I say, when it starts hitting them in the pocket. And I don't want to see, suffering and death needlessly is not a good look. I don't care who it is. I don't want to see it. But, when it starts hitting them in the pocket and when it starts becoming more and more of them suffering, maybe it'll wake them up, and then they'll begin to realize, oh, a mask isn't that bad of a thing. Maybe I could do that mask, or maybe the vaccine, you don't know what's in that moonshine you've been drinking all these years. Take the vaccine. I don't know what it's going to take.
I have come to the same conclusion that you have, that at this point, like, they've offered, free drinks and lotteries. You could win all this money and vacations and all kinds of wacky stuff. Like, at this point, football tickets and all the rest of it, you can go see Drew Brees and everybody else. At this point, the people that are going to take it, I think they've done it. And even the firing, I have seen droves of white people, again, not black people, but I have even seen droves of white people who, what? We got to, in order to keep this job, I got to get the vaccine? Let me get to work writing my resignation letter. It has been amazing. They had the front page of the Seattle Times here. They were talking about they were concerned about not having enough workers for the ferry system because they were mandating the vaccine, and they had tons of white employees. I'm not doing it. I'll just be leaving. Oh, well, take my 20 years of experience, and I'm out of here.
Right.
And who has the luxury to do that? Because who's been making, you know, who's been benefiting from a wage inequity for the last four, well, big wage inequity for most of the 200 of those 200 years, because we wouldn't get paid nothing for all the work we did. But who's been benefiting from wage inequity for 150 years? White folk. So you've been making more money. You know, you had a house in a nice neighborhood way before any black person could because of redlining. So you've been building wealth way longer. So when they tell you either get vaccinated or you lose your job, my wealth is what? 6 cents for every dollar you have. You can write a letter of resignation. Me, on the other hand, I got to say, well, like I said, we've been used a lot longer to being told what to do. You know, so they up in arms about it, but I don't know what to tell them. I don't know what to tell them. I do know this. I have seen more and more cases, you know, of a lot of white folks being personally impacted, and I don't know. Maybe that's what it's going to take for them to realize, okay. But then again, you know, I don't know. I stopped a long time ago trying to figure them people out, Gus. You know what? I'm in real for. I stopped a long time ago trying to figure them people out. I don't know. I do know that it's not us who's widespread not getting vaccinated. I know that it's not us who don't want to, you know, yield to mask mandates. That's not us. That's not us.
The numbers that I saw most recently, they said it was approximately 45% of the population that's eligible in the state of Louisiana is vaccinated. So if 55% of your eligible population is not vaccinated, that's got to be like droves of white people. There's no way that, I mean, unless you think none of the black people in the state got vaccinated, and even then you would still have to have droves of white people to make that up. So that's just nonsense. That's racism, white supremacy, typical to just blame black people for anything. It's Ray Nagin's fault. They'll come back and bring him out. It's Ray Nagin's fault that we don't have power back, and, you know, he messed things up from a decade ago. The folks that dialed in, make sure you didn't miss anybody. If you have a question you want to get in before we allow Ms. Brown to go and recuperate, heal a little bit from having to fuss at the insurance folks and deal with all of this unnecessary anxiety. *61 if you have a question. Don't wait till the last moment if you want to get something in. I guess if I could ask that, that's something that we talked about a lot here and trying to do things to offset all the anxiety. This is kind of unprecedented in terms of stress and anxiety to have to deal with. But under all of the horrendous circumstances that you've had to juggle, have you been able to get some self-care time in for you, your daughter, just to do some things to try to relax for at least 5 minutes or so?
Yeah, you know what? Well, one of the good things is, like I said, we headed to Houston after the storm passed, and I have family out here, so I've had a chance to spend some time with my sister and, you know, just spending some time with family. I have other relatives from New Orleans who also came out this way, my brother, my dad, and so we had a chance to get together. I never turned down a good drink. I mean, you know, I'm definitely on my game. I'm trying to make sure that I keep information flowing to our readers. I am staying on top of my own personal business. But in order to stay sane and just kind of have a moment where I can breathe, you know, I have enjoyed time with family when I've needed to. I have not turned down a good glass of cognac. Today I got a pedicure. I would definitely tell people when you can, if it's nothing more than 5 minutes in a quiet room alone, whenever you can find a moment to just breathe and reflect and, you know, definitely thank God for being alive, but, you know, just have a little personal time where you're not, you know, anxious and arguing and all wound up. It helps. So whatever that is for you, I know what it is for me, and I have taken every moment that I can to do it in between all the other stuff I got to do. Otherwise, y'all would probably see me hanging from a roof somewhere. I don't know. It would not be pretty. So whatever that is for you, full family fun, if you can get it in, if you have relatives, if you've evacuated with relatives, and y'all just are spending time together in the midst of trying to navigate everything else you have to navigate. You know, just a funny aside, you know, when Katrina happened and people were, and FEMA was a little different 16 years ago, so they had started, you know, $2,000 to everybody really, really fast, and some people were making little snide comments about how they saw some of the evacuees using that $2,000, and I'm like, people just came through, you know, waist-deep flood water with dead bodies floating in it, and you mad because they got a fifth a jack with, they need a drink. Leave people alone. Like, let people do whatever it is they need to do to relax and get their minds together to deal with some of the issues they have to deal with. Because I tell you, you know, it is, it's not even just navigating and dealing with the insurance company or trying to deal with FEMA if that's what you have to do, or figuring out when you can go back home. Maybe your house is ready, you can go back home, but your job isn't. Or maybe your job is ready, but your house isn't. It's so many different issues people are dealing with. So whatever it is you feel like you need to do, long as it's legal, whatever you feel like you need to do to rest, relax, and unwind, I encourage you to do it.
I am not mad at all. In fact, I hope you get the stun on them with the open-toe sandals, show off the pedicure. If you got to be on the phone, cursing at the insurance people, at least, like, toes are sparkling.
My toes look good.
I love it. And even the hypocrisy, that's one thing I'll make sure I get in. Like, man, I remember that from 2005 with the refugees, as they were called. People to talk, you know, make some sort of snide remark and, oh, they got some Jack Daniels or got a flat screen TV or whatever.
They got liquor that they need a drink. Leave them alone.
Come on. The toxic flood water, I thought I was going to die. I might have watched my neighbors die or relatives die or whatever else. Thought I was going
to
die. So we set
out. I just had to be
pushed
off a roof.
Come on. Come on. We sat in the Superdome in sewage for a week and all the rest of it. I mean, and the contrast. Now, are you telling me that in the French Quarter, either or, Katrina or Ida, the white people that came, the power that came back, because the French Quarter got power first both times. So when the power came back on, nobody went and, oh, let me get a cold one. Man, that didn't happen. Nobody.
Right.
let me go to Lafitte and get a nice mojito or tequila whiskey. That didn't happen. None of the ones.
No,
they all
did.
Just got mineral water and had some sort of fruit smoothie, no alcohol in it, and just got to work. That's what happened?
Nah, that ain't what happened. You know it ain't.
Come on. The hypocrisy. Did we miss any folks' question they wanted to get in from Ms. Brown?
I had another question, if possible.
That is V's mom in California. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I have two questions. One question was, do you have an understanding of the reasoning as to why the government would not mandate an evacuation? That's my first question. And my second question would be, if you are around any children right now, how are they dealing with the COVID plus Ida plus, like, not being in school? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So the first question, you know, it's kind of the same reasons why I ended up not evacuating initially and staying in the city, getting a hotel room. This really all kind of happened kind of quickly. Usually, a lot of times, they're watching these storms and they're forming kind of slowly, and they're looking at them for maybe 4 or 5, sometimes 7 days in advance. They see this. Best as I can tell from what I remember, my own, when I, you know, just kind of, it got on my radar, it happened kind of quickly. Wednesday night into Thursday morning, it was like, oh, there's a storm out here and it's coming our direction. You get to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which is the time people are prepping, deciding what they're going to do. those are sharp days when you, you know, if you're trying to decide whether or not you're going to have a mandatory evacuation, you're looking at what the storm is doing. And so in all, you know, difference to the officials, I think that they honestly really felt like they did not have enough time to call for a mandatory evacuation inside the levee protection system. Now, they did quickly call for one outside. And let's, you know, hands up to the Army Corps engineers and all the other entities that worked on rebuilding levees that failed 16 years ago. You know, we didn't have widespread flooding, no levee breaches in New Orleans this go around. And this was a storm of similar magnitude minus the levee failure and flooding. And so, again, I think they just didn't feel like they had enough time to make that call. So they did it for people who live outside of the levee protection system and made the call to be a voluntary evacuation for people inside the levee protection system. As to your other question, you know, I have had the opportunity. One of my nieces is also in Houston, evacuated, and she has young kids. You know, it depends on the age and just how in tune they are with what's happening. You know, I'm looking at a 5- and 6-year-old who are just excited not to be in school, to be somewhere else, and they're not really, you know, understanding fully the magnitude of what's going on. When they get a little bit older, you know, they're a little more quiet, and you really are wondering how they're processing all of this, even though, again, you know, this isn't at the same level of Katrina. This won't be a situation where people are away for months and months. You know, it's going to be weeks at the most for even some of the hardest hit places, you know, before people can get back to home. But I look at, you know, my 16 and 17-year-old great nieces, and, you know, they're really quiet, really pensive, and I'm just wondering exactly what they're thinking, you know, and if they're looking at it with the same eyes that I might look at it, because, again, when I look at it, I see the disparities and the inequities that are, you know, shown by these types of events, and, you know, and I get mad, and I want to fight somebody. But, you know, I don't think that, you know, even at 16 or 17, that's the radar they're on. They're just maybe, you know, would rather be in school or would rather be home, but get why they're not there, and it's maybe not much more than that for them, or maybe it is, and they don't know how to vocalize it.
Thank you.
I don't know. You're welcome. I do know, and let me say this, I do know one of the failures post-Katrina, because that thing was, Katrina, what happened in the aftermath of Katrina was a very violent aftermath, and I'm not talking about gunshots, or I'm talking about the actual, those days and weeks in New Orleans after Katrina, the death, the devastation, being up in the convention center of the Superdome in those conditions, having to be plucked off of a roof with your family. And that was traumatic, period. And we didn't, I think, address that trauma the way that it should have been addressed for young people, for children then. They were taught, I think, through Katrina, in their eyes, they were taught one thing, and that's that no one cares. If you can, you know, leave me here in these conditions, and it takes, you know, weeks and weeks to come rescue me and my family, no one cares. And when I look at some of the violence that has ensued in New Orleans in the last 10 or so years, you know, a lot of times if we age that right, some of these 15, you know, some of these even the younger adults, 20-ish, you know, these were children of Katrina who experienced a great deal of trauma that we did not address, that we did not take seriously. And so I'm not a mental health care professional, but I definitely would say that we should not take that lightly, and that, you know, for those people who are in those spaces where that is supposed to happen, whether it's school, through social work programs, we should not take that lightly, and we should especially be talking to our children, because trauma is so real in our communities. We experience it every day and all the time, and then these kinds of situations just bust open, you know, make it so much more vivid, and it's right there, and so we shouldn't take it lightly, and we should make sure that our children, you know, are able to talk about what they need to talk about and work through things from that, from a mental health standpoint. Because the trauma is real. Anyway, it was so great to be on the program. Call me again if you need me.
It was phenomenal to have you back on the broadcast with us. Again, wish it could have been better circumstances where you just got a pedicure and are chilling out on the beach and enjoying a wonderful conclusion to the summer. But I'm glad you all are relatively safe, and hopefully you will get that notification. Power has been back on for 24 hours, and everyone can come back, get rolling with the recovery and self-care. Like, more self-care.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us this evening. Folks can definitely stay abreast the New Orleans Tribune. It's online. You can follow on Twitter to get information about
www.theneworleanstribune.com. We are on Facebook, The New Orleans Tribune, Twitter, NO Tribune, and Instagram, I think, is The New Orleans Tribune, too. We're everywhere. Please follow us. Subscribe to our go to our website and subscribe to our e-blast list so you can get weekly emails from the Tribune.
www.theneworleanstribune.com.
Great, guys.
Thank you so much for sharing some of your time. You could have been doing self-care. Instead, you were hanging out talking with us. We are super grateful, and we'll look forward to speaking with you again in much, much better times. Again, Ms. Anitra Brown, editor at the New Orleans Tribune, thanks so much for speaking with us, and take excellent care of yourself and your daughter.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Context of white supremacy. This would count, but now we can't really call this Katrina work, per se, because this has branched out. So we have done signature work on hurricanes and white supremacy in the New Orleans area. There we go. Self-care. Cannot emphasize that enough. I've just heard that over and over with tons of black people, some of them where they didn't have any health problems or anything. They were able to evacuate. They left, no problem. Their house was relatively okay. Some of them had a lot more damage, but hearing the same type of thing, having to brawl and fight with white people frequently, sometimes non-white people who work for white people, but either or, having to brawl and fight, paperwork, phone calls, going around and around, wasting all kinds of time and energy, and then white people not doing the correct thing, not being compensated correctly or at all in some instances. I mean, there were documentaries and things on that specifically, books and all kinds of reports. The insurance companies made a killing, literally and figuratively, after Katrina. Home Depot, lots of folks cleaned up. Everybody came out like bandits except for black people. What she said at the conclusion I thought was so important. I think that was from Z's question. Z's mom, sorry. Z is important too, but Z's mom's question. About the children, I can even pause. Let me see if I can find it. I played it on accident, right? I think within the last 10 days or so, just as we were waiting to go live. And let's see. There's a report called Children of Katrina, and it talks about the mental health aspect.
If that's it, I'll just play it. Oh, that's PSD. Not sure if that's it. I'll have to double check. But they talked about how you had all of these children who went through everything that she just said, Ms. Brown, being plucked off the roof or crammed in the Superdome or Crescent City Bridge. That incident, Gary Rivlin said people should think about that the same way they do the late John Lewis being at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Black people walking to safety. Oh, my gosh, we could die. The city's flooded. Let's get to high ground. Being met, even black police officers being met by a white mob at gunpoint. Get out of here. Looters, refugees, come in here and rape our women. You had children in that group and elderly and all the rest, but, I mean, it was children, you know. Who said, like, what does that do to children? Are sensitive, right? They have, like, soap and detergent and toothbrushes and things and food that is just for children. They won't even let children under 12 get the Rona vaccine, right? Children are sensitive. Imagine that. You go through that. Wading through sewage. Wasn't even water. Toxic flood water. That was what we called it. Sewage and all the dead bodies. Ms. Brown said they got video of all that. I mean, this is beyond gruesome. School is closed indefinitely. And then they had reports in what I'm talking about, children of Katrina. They get plucked out. This happened the same day, August 29th. So school year was either just about to start or you maybe have been there a day. Now it's canceled indefinitely. Might be back in a month. In some cases, might not be back at all. And you go pluck to a school in Utah or Houston, and, oh, my God, we've got some of the looters here. They said they had all these little nicknames for them. You know, they nicknamed the black people. I think they called, what was it? That's the Nala gang. Ooh. They had all these little cute terms. Wow, you all have been through one of the most traumatic events in life. Like, what kind of counseling can you get you in therapy and going to make sure that everybody is really calm and patient and we don't do anything to trigger you. I know it's going to be a really anxious time. Yeah, the looters. Ugh. The theory they repeated, there's a theory. It's exactly what Ms. Brown said, that the folks who were 10, the black children who were 10, 8, 5, 12, when all of that happened, or even 15, whatever, those folks, young adults now, the lesson that they learned, black lives don't matter. And so that's how they behave. Black people don't matter. Do whatever. Treat them however I want to, because black people don't matter. That's what you showed. Left us to die, called us looters and all the rest of it. Black people don't matter. That's what their brain computer, tabulated. What else would you think? Let me see if I got the report on accident, because they're you can look this up. Children of Katrina. Some of this came out when it was what they call tacky, in a tacky way, the 10-year anniversary in 2015. They had some of this reporting. I think there was like a book and several other. They might have had some short YouTube sections and such. Let's see if this is it.
Charles Music lives in St. Bernard Parish. He says his life will never be the same.
I mean, it's hard to get back to normal, you know, after you lose everything you had.
Only one picture from his home was saved.
It was very hard, very, very hard to get back on our feet.
Music and many others are impacted emotionally. He says he has bouts of anxiety, stress, and depression.
I just want to be by myself. I go in my room, close the door. Like, leave me alone.
Like many businesses, the popular restaurant, Rocky and Carlo's, had to rebuild too. It's a place for locals, and it's here that people opened up to us and told us about their emotional times.
The threat of it all being taken away again, and the mayor saying, you know, hell's coming, you know, you really, I was a basket case.
Dr. Charles Figley from Tulane University says it's common for us to have feelings of nervousness, anxiety, or PTSD because we do have traumatic memories.
After the initial bang of Katrina and the shock of the city filling up with water, there were these continuous insults, continuous traumatic events.
Experts say the impact is widespread, deep, and enduring. Adults suffered, but children did too. Save the Children released its national 2015 report card that shows 2 years after the storm, one study of adults found that 1 in 12 residents wanted to kill themselves. 4 years after the storm, another study found one-third of low-income mothers suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder.
This is normal and natural, and these are the things that you can do in order to fix it permanently. And the way you fix it permanently is as simple as remembering it and learning the lessons.
Dr. Figley says reactions will be different year after year.
With regard to the anniversary, it's highly likely that people will start thinking about it more than they've ever done for a while.
And after 10 years of having feelings of anger or sadness, now it's time, he says, to switch to a positive mindset.
If we take a deep breath, and we recognize how far we've come in 10 years, it indicates how strong we are. People are going to grieve forever. If you lose almost 2,000 people in your city, I mean, that's something you should never, ever forget.
On your side, Camille Whitworth, WDSU News.
Although informative,
that is not the report that I wanted, but there are a plethora. There's a book specifically, exactly as I said, Children of Katrina, and then The Atlantic. They did a report, The Lost Children of Katrina, a decade after. I told you a lot of this stuff came out 2015. A decade after the hurricane, New Orleans community grapples with the effects of missed schooling and mass displacement. The image that they have is a school bus that just looks like it got swept away in the flood and hurricane. The poignant thing about that is that there were a lot of images of school buses that were flooded and crushed and, you know, swept up. Like, anywho, just a quick snippet. It says, an untold number of kids, children, probably numbering in the tens of thousands, missed weeks, months, even years of school after Katrina. They've already said, Ms. Brown said this evening, might be, or it's not a might, we heard that at the audio clip too at the beginning, close to 50,000 students are probably going to miss a month or so of school. Probably a lot of black children. Only now, a decade later, are advocates and researchers beginning to grasp the lasting effects of this post-storm duress. Increasingly, they believe the same lower-income teens, black teens, who waded through the city's toxic floodwaters and spent several rootless years afterward may now be helping drive a surging need for GED programs and entry-level job training programs in the city. It's no coincidence, they say, that Louisiana has the nation's highest rate of young adults not in school or working. Many of the Americans who today lack both jobs and diplomas may have been Katrina-era adolescents who often suffered such high levels of trauma and instability that learning became nearly impossible. It was like throwing seeds at cement, said Lisa Celeste Green-Derry, a New Orleans-based education researcher. Seeds to cement, metaphor. Anyway, the report goes on, but it talks a lot about that. It says, I think 90% plus of my students didn't learn for a year after Katrina. Now, even that is hard to grasp because a lot of knowledge that we get in the current school system is cumulative, meaning that what you learn on Wednesday, you build on that for Thursday, and so on. So if you miss an entire year, that's the type of thing where you end up with a lot of folks who end up dropping out. Like, a year can be very difficult to overcome for a lot of students, especially if you spent that entire year not in a classroom setting. Lots of folks, that is it. They end up dropping out, or they are not going to finish and get that diploma. Like, can be irreparable harm academically. Black babies cost less. Let's see. Before I'll check in to see if any folks have any thoughts that they would like to get in, what we heard from Ms. Brown, I would just say I'm super excited for the book club. Very vindicated. If you've been following along Woody Allen, apropos of nothing, where folks are saying, man, he's not talking about Su-Yi and this tragic arrangement, and how did he end up hooking up with this female who is 35 years younger than him and who is the adopted daughter of the white woman that he has been so-called dating for a decade. The last half of the book is focused on that intensely. So, and beginning tomorrow, we will get lots and lots of details and all the reasons that I wanted to read this book. Now until conclusion, that's what it'll be focused on. Wow, I'm just the content. Oh, yeah. I'm super excited for the book club tomorrow, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That's it. Super happy that we could have Ms. Brown on the broadcast for the evening. And I mean, I'm not sure. If I had been in that type of predicament and an attempted parent, I don't know. Like, Gus, you will have to holler at me, like, once I'm back at the residence, maybe. We have electricity, and I can prop my manicured, pedicured feet up in my house, in my bed. Then maybe we can talk. While I'm out here in Houston for some undetermined amount of time, and I got to fight with FEMA to get my money back and everything, like, it's only so much energy that I have each day, and I might have had to tap out for Wednesday, so kudos to her for making time with us. Incidentally, I would say when self-care time comes, like, I would say try to find something other than alcohol. That moron, he does say sobriety would be best. And I just say that because they've had many reports throughout the last year, maybe more than that now, just saying how there's been a great increase in alcohol consumption over the pandemic in total. So, and that's not healthy, that's, you know, liver damage and lots of other health problems, diabetes, weight gain, lots of, you know, nothing healthy is going to come with an increase in alcohol consumption. So I would say try to find, I know in those traumatic moments, that, I mean, really, the system of white supremacy, that's how we're programmed, you know. Oh, let's go to happy hour. Oh, we had a tough day. Let's get a drink, that sort of thing. That is widely advertised throughout the system of white. Wait till football season starts. I mean, woo-wee. Advertising some liquors of all types. But try to find things that, she said, hanging out with a family, Miss Brown did. Spend some time with her sister, nieces, nephews. All that is spectacular. Get some good food. Plant-based, we hope. Being able to go outside. She even said just 5 minutes where you can breathe, get some quiet space. Super important. Self-care. Especially even if, I mean, if you're in the Louisiana area and dealing with it, really, folks in New York are neglecting, we were just talking about New Orleans, but certainly people in New Orleans who got the remnants and they had all that flooding in the subway and the Pennsylvania area, just climate change, environmental racism, one of the same. So certainly a lot of folks had to deal with the remnants of all that, but wow, the just the situation in New Orleans, hopefully folks got a little bit more information. You can be mindful of what's happening down there and how it's impacting black people. Another example of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Did any of the folks that are with us on the line have any comments, thoughts they wanted to make sure they get in, what they heard from Ms. Brown? Okay.
grants and folks are processing. Can only say, again, reminder, try to be prepared, especially if you live, you know, in Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, California, areas where they, Seattle, we have an active volcano here. They have volcano drills. So, like, the craziest thing in the world when I got here, like, do what? Volcano evacuation? I'm like, do what? Here in Hawaii, I can, yeah, those two spots. Volcano and eruption hazards. But, I mean, hey, that's serious. Like, people die. Those events do happen. So earthquakes, whatever it is, like, take those events seriously and try to plan as best you can, especially if you have offspring. Go through a plan where you all are supposed to rendezvous at. I think we had folks who talked before, like important documents, passports and things, whatever other identification that you're going to need. Have all of that stuff, especially if you have, you know, a attempted family. Have all of that stuff in your Ziploc bags in a secure location so that you could just, bam, great. You don't have to do a whole lot of running around. You know exactly where that is. Bang, have your material. Folks know what they're going to get. If you all have to leave quickly, you can even take some practice runs. If this has to be, we have to evacuate. We heard that, hey, the evacuation can be on a time frame. Might have, you know, we don't have a whole lot of time to dally, so we have to be brisk and efficient in doing this. So maybe do some practice turns if you're going to stay. If you have a facility where, hey, this is, we can just stay here. It's just a matter of maybe having a generator, having food to make sure that we can eat, having water. That's, you know, always a super important one. Whatever other essentials, if that's medication, reading material, what is it, one of those little hand crank radios, that sort of thing, flashlights, batteries. The devices so that you can keep your cell phones charged, whatever, you know, you think you might need. Make sure you're gathering those devices, especially in the midst of, you know, COVID-19, like all the wacky hours and random closures and shortages. Try to have all that stuff on hand. Make sure that it works. Or be in the process of gathering those materials and getting things together so that you don't have to kind of be running around at the last minute. Can be dangerous. Anywho, we will be here Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, the book club sixth session on Woody Allen's autobiography, Tragic Arrangements. And then we'll be here Friday as well, neutralizing workplace racism. Much obliged to all of the investors who have supported the context of white supremacy for 12-plus years. I hope the broadcast has been continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. We are also at Cash App, cash.app/$thecows. Enormous gratitude to all the folks who have kept us on the air. Hopefully we have been worthy of your time and energy and shared a little bit of constructive info. I'll share this tidbit really quick, and then we can wrap up unless somebody has anything they need to share about what they heard this evening. We had a listener who emailed me, and she wanted to know how to respond. She had an older victim. When I say older, I believe over 60. Gusty might not even get there. So, but she said that she was talking to this person and they said, you know, yes, I know, you know, racism is real, that exists, but we, meaning black people, we are out here killing each other and causing all kinds of problems and things, and we kill way more of each other than the Klan ever did. And she wanted to know, you know, what's the best response? My opinion, I generally make an assessment, like that's one of the first questions we ask when we have guests on the program. I didn't ask Ms. Brown today because she's been a guest repeatedly, so I asked her the first time she was a guest. But one of the first questions I ask is, system of racism, white supremacy. Definition, global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. I ask, are we in agreement? Does that exist? And if they say no, oof. That right there, not going to be a whole lot. For me, talking to a non-white person, not going to be a whole lot else. If I'm talking to them and I get the assessment that they are very confused about racism, white supremacy, I'm still learning myself, but this is not something that they study. This is not something that they're trying to get more information about, that they're just repeating what they've heard. Black people can be racist too, that sort of thing. I generally don't do a lot of challenging. I'll make an assessment to, is this person open to rethinking some of their ideas? If the answer is no, I don't do a lot of challenging or questioning. I don't say anything. They just say whatever they say. Then I just listen quietly. That way we don't have any conflict. Now, if they are receptive to asking some questions and maybe reconsidering some of their views, I just ask questions and try to follow logic. But many victims, we have been discouraged from using logic. So often silence is the best way to go. I found especially the older we get, sometimes it can be more challenging to release some of the views that we've held on to for a long time and say, maybe I can look at this a different way. Not everybody, but for a number of people, it can be difficult. The longer that you've had those views or beliefs, even if they're incorrect, it can be difficult to release them. So hey, it's difficult to get into conflict if you're not saying a whole lot. If we're just going to sit here and talk or share points, exchange views for 5 hours, and you're going to have the same viewpoint. What was the metaphor? It's like throwing seeds at cement. Mm-hmm. Yes, I try to be selective about planting seeds and hopefully hitting environments where they will grow. Although seeds will surprise you sometimes. They do have that, what is it, Tupac said about rose grow from concrete? Way too many metaphors for one program. Everyone satisfied? Got any final thoughts, observations? Suggestion. Grant, we will be here 24 hours. Woody Allen's autobiography. Woody. Sobriety would be best. Let's say it again. Very important to preserve our brain computers. We will need a lot of high-level thinking to solve our problems. There's so much going on in the universe right now. I was laughing at one of the investors said, don't they call this the end times? Like, it may be. Who knows? With everything that is happening, this is not the time to be confronting strangers in public. I just saw a report. I would have asked her if it had been other circumstances. Ms. Brown, I think it was in Louisiana. They were having all the pileups at the gas station, people having to wait in line for hours and things to get gas. It was a shooting, and I believe it was a black person shot and killed a white person. And it's saying it's stand your ground. When you're out, you cannot. This is not the time to be getting into verbal disputes with strangers. You should be thinking, this person may be armed. In fact, this person might have an entire armed entourage. If you didn't leave your house ready to kill and or die, exit. This is not the time to be in verbal confrontations with strangers. In fact, the report, if I read it correctly, I think this was in freaking Louisiana. It might have been close to New Orleans. But they said the black fella, victim, he went back to his vehicle, grabbed his firearm, and the white man put his arms out like, what, you going to shoot me? Have you not been paying attention to the news? People are getting shot over corn dogs, roll of toilet paper. Yes, I think you could get shot over some gas, and especially I had to wait in line 5 hours. They're talking about gas shortages. It's not that I need this to just put in my vehicle just to go cruising and such. I might need this gas to put in the generator to make sure that our refrigerator or air conditioning unit or dialysis machine or whatever. Like, yes, you could be shot and killed at the gas station over 5 gallons of gas. Yes. And in fact, I believe they said this, a white man was shot and killed by a black person. People went about getting their gas. End times. If it's not end times, it's at least like, wow, be especially cautious when you're out and about. Oh, did I miss a hand? Let's see. Missy, non-Clemson grad, did y'all have comments you all wanted to get in before we wrap things up?
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, PALS listeners. This is Missy from South Carolina. Coincidentally, I had a friend contact me this afternoon, and he shared that he was in New Orleans today. And I think he's been there maybe like for a week and a half. And he's been on the debris cleanup crew as well as serving food, like the catering crew as well. And he said they have to serve like 2,000 people just outside of New Orleans in Hammond, Louisiana. But he said out of the 2,000 people that they have to feed breakfast, lunch, dinner, they've only fed like 1,000 people so far, but he's doing 20-hour days, and he shared that if you need work or if you need a if you are in need of income or if you need to generate a lot of cash very quickly, he said that they are paying $5,000 to go down there. And then $20 per hour, but he is working extended hours. And I asked him how long or how many weeks he expected to be there. He said probably for 3 or 4 more weeks, and he may be relocated to another camp. So it is long days. Like he was saying, yesterday he finished at midnight. Then they brought him back in at 4:30. He worked until noon, got like 3.5 hours worth of rest before 3:30, having to start on dinner. And he said from 3:30 to 9 o'clock the next day in the morning, he would be on the clock. So it is a lot of hours, but he said after the job is done, he's looking at probably $25,000 to $30,000. And you don't get paid until after the job is done. So I just wanted to share that, and it was very important to share for the Aftermath Cows, Aftermath of Hurricane Ida Cows broadcast. And with that, I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Missy, in South Carolina, and wowee. $25,000. I guess you said he is working extended hours, but hey, if folks are interested, check it out. See if we can get more information. If you can find it online, let me know. See if we can get more details. But yeah, that seems like something that might be of interest to any of the folks out there listening in. Wowee. And right on for being able to go help. I know there were a lot of folks who were having a tough time with meals and all that. No refrigeration. No stove, no means to cook anything. So right on for being able to go and help out. That is a lot of folks to feed, 1,000. Like, wow. With that, I did the sobriety part. If you're driving, not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention for lots of reasons. And we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers. Badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time
we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling, no gossiping. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.